Okay, well, let's dive into it. This morning in part 10 of our series, we want to look at how to interact with non-Christians on the subject of homosexuality. You will remember that recently in parts 7 and 8 and 9 leading up to this, we focused on those involved with or influenced by the pro-gay movement within the church itself, how to answer the various arguments that come from those who identify themselves as Christians, those who, for instance, would use scripture or theology. But now we want to turn our attention toward those who make no such claims at all, who care nothing about the Bible nor the God of the Bible. How then, with them, can we best make a case for heterosexuality and a case against homosexuality? Well, obviously, this is going to be a bit more of a challenge, and the fact that we are interacting with non-Christians means that this is now a completely different ball game. Different rules are involved. When engaging someone who claims to be a believer, well, we can go back and forth, but we have together a common ground of Scripture and the character of God. Both parties share, or at least are supposed to share, the same objective of embracing a position that honors the Lord. But this obviously is not going to be the case with non-believers. And so the whole approach must be categorically different, altogether different. For instance, simply quoting Bible verses to make your point is just not going to have much effect. Now, in regards to this subject, we're going to find ourselves engaged with, I guess what I would categorize as three different kinds of non-believers. First, there are going to be those who are actually practicing homosexuals. They're open about it. They don't try to hide anything. In this series, I've been referring to them as gay, to use the old traditional understanding of that. We also have those who struggle with homosexual desires privately. They may or may not act on such desires, but they do approve of homosexual behavior. And then there are, of course, heterosexuals who condone or approve of homosexuality. Anything from, let's just leave them alone, they're not hurting anyone, to being an aggressive activist for the cause. And so the material that I'll be covering today can be easily adapted to each or any of the three. It's important that we keep in mind that it's not essential for us to know about a person's own sexual preferences or practices, the one that we're interacting with. The only thing we need to be mindful of is that the person approves of homosexual relationships and doesn't claim to be a follower of Christ. That's what today's material is geared toward. Now, there are several arguments that can be effective with non-believers, and we've already touched on a couple of these in this series. One approach is to talk about public health concerns. You may remember some of the statistics I shared last week about the increased rate of STDs, depression, alcohol and drug abuse, sexual addiction, AIDS, suicide, and so on among those involved in homosexual relationships. These facts are not disputed, they're readily available, and most people will certainly be somewhat receptive to the argument. Certainly, we must be hesitant to enthusiastically promote a lifestyle that puts people in harm's way. Another approach is to talk about the common good for society. The mental and physical health risk that homosexuality poses on society itself is enough to cause concern. But in addition to this is the well-being of our families. The health and strength of the family unit is fundamental to a healthy and strong society. And studies show that monogamous heterosexual marriages are the best environments for raising children. Mothers count. Fathers count. Love and commitment between the spouses count. The reasons for all of this are very sound and compelling. And again, resources that address all this are readily available, and the facts speak for themselves. This, however, just to clarify, does not mean that a homosexual couple who adopt children would be bad parents or that their adopted children would necessarily suffer in such a home. Certainly, there are examples where these sorts of arrangements have not been detrimental, perhaps even in some situations positive. But the point here is that the findings of all of these studies cannot be dismissed. The research does stand and it does speak for itself. And so just because there may be some cases where it has worked out okay, doesn't offset the many, many more where it hasn't. And so the question that one must ask, and it is a legitimate one, is this: given what we know about the negative effects homosexual relationships have upon families and society. Can we really justify promoting such relationships as normal or good or even equal to marriage? Another point that can be effective is to talk about the legal and social fallout of legalizing, in particular here, same-sex marriage. Once the standard of a one-man, one-woman marriage is broken, there is no logical stopping point. You are familiar with this. You've heard this for a number of years, the problems that this will lead to. Polygamists, as you know, are already standing in line, waiting to be next. And so the question is, even we can even take it to the next point, upon what grounds could we even deny incest? What if a father and daughter wanted to marry, or a brother and sister, or three brothers and a mother? Where does the whole thing end? What's to prevent marriage between humans and animals? Well, these, you know, are pretty much unlikely scenarios. But the point is, if you change the definition of marriage so as not to discriminate against homosexuals, then everything goes, or some other group is going to be discriminated against. And when it comes down to it, why would marriage even have to involve commitment or fidelity or even love? If we're going to redefine things, why does it have to have that? Giving non-marital relationships the same status as marriage does not expand the definition of marriage. It actually destroys it. And here's an example. If you declare that because it has similar properties, wine should be labeled identically to grape juice, you have, in essence, destroyed the definitions of both wine and grape juice, because the consumer would not know what he is getting. And, of course, the same is true of marriage. Any redefinition of it would eventually become meaningless, resulting in serious harm to the institution itself. Now, like the other arguments, this one will have appeal to some and perhaps not so much to others, but I think it does need to be stated that through the centuries, in nations all over the world, marriage has and is of such importance that it is uniquely protected in the law and in culture. And we do need to remember that it does predate our Constitution. As one writer put it, it is an anthropological and sociological reality, not primarily a legal one. It transcends every political system. No civilization can survive without it, and those societies that allowed it to become irrelevant have faded into history. All right, well, each of these three approaches can be effective, and it would serve us well to be somewhat equipped in them. In each one, the objective is to show the practical advantages of heterosexuality and the practical disadvantages of homosexuality. However, there are some limitations with these, as there are with any argument that is solely based on what is practical. For example, people today are more compelled by the "I should have the right to do whatever I want to do" type arguments than the "research shows" type arguments. In other words, appealing to the practical side of things isn't always that compelling to everybody. For every study or statistic or example that we might raise, someone could probably try to counter it with another, you know, an exception to the rule, which then is used to negate the whole point. And so I am of the school of thought that at some point we need to push beyond the practical arguments and actually challenge this whole business of "I should have the right to do whatever I want to do" type arguments and address the root issue itself, that of moral absolutes. This, I believe, is where we really need to make our case, the morality of homosexual relationships. And it begins with a simple question. If there is a universal morality, moral obligations that all people everywhere at all times are compelled to honor, and if is there such a morality, and if so, how are these obligations or moral laws determined? Does a person actually have a right to do whatever he or she pleases? And this, of course, is the question that lies at the heart, the whole heart, of the controversy of homosexuality. And it should be here in particular that our conversations with non-believers need to move toward. And addressing the question of whether there is a universal morality has, of course, this added benefit of opening up opportunities to talk about God and what God has revealed in Scripture. So I want to spend some time on this one. The moral argument is a big one. We can't possibly cover it exhaustively this morning, and so my plan is to simply sketch out a basic roadmap of what this case looks like and kind of let you run with it from there. There's a number of books and resources available on this in our library if you would like to pursue this more on your own. The great thing about this particular approach is that the door is actually kicked wide open for us from the very beginning, right at the start. For instance, think about this. We constantly hear that same-sex marriage is a matter of marriage equality, and therefore anyone who opposes it is intolerant and a bigot. We hear that sort of thing all the time. But I want you to notice what kind of an argument that is. Even though it doesn't appeal to any religious belief or biblical text, it is an explicitly moral argument. It implies that justice, individual rights, and a commitment to equality should lead one to support same-sex marriage. It appeals to moral principles that, in this case, most Americans, Christians or not, do believe in. We might despise the implications of the argument, but the argument itself, if said to us in a one-to-one conversation, would actually be a gift. Whenever anyone appeals to moral principles to make their case, they really do. They just kick the door wide open enough for us to drive a semi-truck through. Non-believers simply don't have a proper foundation for these moral standards that they appeal to. And without that foundation, we can easily uncover the weaknesses and problems of their positions, and in addition to this, direct them to a proper foundation upon which we can build proper positions. The absence of a foundation can be fleshed out with questions like, why is justice better than injustice? Why are individual rights a good thing? Why must we have a commitment to equality? Any answer that they do provide here will certainly try to appeal to a universal moral absolute, but it is an absolute that they won't be able to explain or define or even defend. Why am I obligated to be tolerant? Isn't it hypocritical for you to be intolerant of my intolerance? Ironically enough, one of the best things that can happen to get the ball rolling is to be called a bigot. That itself is a moral statement. It opens the door. Why do you say that? Even if it is true, why is it wrong to be a bigot? Anytime homosexuality is either defended or advanced, it is done so on the back of a moral argument of some sort. And it comes out almost immediately when the conversation turns to this subject. You hear things like, people should have the right to do whatever they want to do. No one should impose their beliefs on others. This is how I am wired. I should have the right to be faithful to my true nature. I am in love. I am committed to my lover. How can this be wrong? And so on. Every argument you have ever heard or will hear is based on some moral principle that, it is assumed, every person recognizes and that every person is obligated to abide by. This is a gift. It really is. The topic of foundation for morality is our strong suit. This is our playing field. This is our ball game. Our home court. It all boils down to what is good and what is evil. And that's a question that we can answer, and our answer can be explained and defended. Here's another example, so bear with me as I continue to try to flesh this out. A homosexual might say something like, I am in a committed, faithful, loving relationship. What difference does it make whether it is heterosexual or homosexual? Well, there are all sorts of ways you could approach that, but I would say to head this in the right direction, we could ask something like, what if the relationship wasn't committed or faithful, or loving, and see what the response is. If he says that such an arrangement would be wrong, then the question becomes, well, what would make it wrong? Upon what grounds would you condemn a homosexual relationship that isn't based on commitment, faithfulness, and love? Any answer he gives will set things up perfectly. If instead he claims that homosexual relationships are okay, even if there isn't any commitment or love, then ask him if there are any boundaries at all. He's going to have boundaries, even if he tries not to have them. Would sex with 500 different partners be okay? How about 1,000? When is it too many? Do parties have to consent to the relationship? Can it be forced? What about all those Catholic priests who molested little boys? Was that level of homosexuality going too far? If you keep pushing the question, then eventually he's going to come up for air and try to appeal to some standard of morality that all of us are supposed to recognize, which again sets things up perfectly. Once a person uses the words like good or bad or better or worse or ought or should or must, they are admitting to something higher that governs all people. Scott Klusendorf has a great approach for this. Some of you have heard this. Whenever anyone tries to argue with him, saying, "You cannot impose your morality on me," he responds with, "Why not?" Now, they think he's being sarcastic, but he is serious. Upon what universal moral principle are you appealing to that I am bound by, which forbids me from imposing my morality on you? And when it comes to the subject at hand, we appeal to the same ideas. Upon what basis can you claim homosexual behavior is okay, or that I am forbidden in condemning it? Or to go the other direction, upon what basis can you say that there should be some limits, that older men, these Catholic priests, forcing homosexual sex on younger boys, that would be morally wrong, or that those who condemn such practices are justified in doing so? All of this is part of moving the ball toward the end zone, of getting them to recognize the natural ramifications of moral principles that are binding on all people. Namely, if there is a universal moral law, then there is a lawgiver. This is where we want to bring them to. For where else could this law come from? I mean, simple matter, atoms and molecules can't write a moral law upon the hearts of men. There must be a someone above and beyond ourselves who is behind this natural moral law, someone who, as the author of this morality, perfect morality, is perfectly moral himself. And once you bring the person to this point, all you have to do is show them that this lawgiver is the God of the Bible, and that this lawgiver has spoken about the morality of more than just things like stealing and lying and murder and injustice and human equality and so forth, but also on sexual relationships like fornication, prostitution, incest, adultery, and yes, homosexuality. And in the end, what the lawgiver has determined to be right and what he has determined to be wrong is the only thing that counts, not our opinions or preferences or desires. All right, now as you can see here, this isn't something that you should expect to accomplish in 5 or 10 minutes. It's going to take some time, probably several different conversations over an extended period. You kind of know, you know, how to go about this. It is a line of reasoning that if you feel like you need to be better equipped in, then I would recommend as a starting point the first 5 chapters of Mere Christianity, where C.S. Lewis lays this out. They're short chapters, easy to follow. And in fact, that would be a convenient way to even to pass that book on to a non-believer that you might be engaged with on that subject. But to summarize here, anytime someone attempts to justify homosexual relationships, which is going to happen immediately in the conversation, the reason is going to be based on some moral argument. But the moral argument is going to lack an actual foundation, a proper foundation. And that gives us, of course, a perfect opportunity to fill in the blanks and connect the dots. There is a foundation, a proper and foolproof and eternal foundation for a universal morality, and that foundation is the God of the Bible. And in this approach, we bring the conversation right on the doorstep of the gospel itself, and which makes a great lead-in for that. All right, now, part two. Just as important as the content of the case we present is the manner in which we present it. So in the second half of this morning's message, I want to turn our attention to this. Whenever we interact with non-believers, especially on a controversial subject like homosexuality, which is emotionally charged, we do need to be armed with the truth. Absolutely. But we also need to be filled with grace. And we have to remember that the goal is not to win the argument, but to win the person, that is, win the person over to the truth. And too many times in our zeal to just win the argument, we end up losing the person. Now, winning the argument, just to be clear, is the goal when it comes to trained professionals performing in a public debate held in front of hundreds of people in a large auditorium. But that isn't what you and I will be doing. You and I will be interacting with friends and neighbors and family members and coworkers and other rank-and-file members of society who in many ways live lives similar to our own. Two key passages should immediately come to mind. And these are ones that we have looked at a number of times in the past many years. Colossians 4, 5 through 6. Look at every word here. Be wise in the way you act toward outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone. And 1 Peter 3:15, always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. So our approach here must incorporate two key ingredients, truth and compassion. Truth speaks to the content of the message. Content addresses the manner in which it is conveyed. According to the first chapter of John's Gospel, this truth and grace model exemplified the ministry of Christ himself. So with this in mind, we need to appreciate as a starting point on this subject that we need to appreciate that most people think Christians hate homosexuals. That's our starting point. And this fact right away should temper our approach. Now, without a doubt, a lot of this is because the media and Hollywood and others have done a pretty good job of painting this picture, that Christians are homophobes and intolerant hate mongers and so on. But yet, on the other hand, we do kind of need to admit that we have, to a large degree, handed them the canvas, the brush, and the paint for many of these portraits. Our routine is pretty basic. It's pretty predictable, actually. Condemn homosexuals and then try to convert them with a shallow cliche. And we really do need a better approach here. So let's talk about the interaction itself, the best way to actually present our case one-on-one. Typically, when engaged on this subject, we drop into this default mode of going into a debate, as seen by trying to press our points with direct statements. We're always eager to do that. Now, there is a place for making direct statements, but the way we make them and the timing of when to make them is everything. You know, we have been conditioned to reason, whoever wins is the one who can trounce the other with the strongest argument. We get that from the debates we watch and TV shows and all this sort of thing. But again, we just have to rid ourselves of that mindset, for simply winning with the most clever argument isn't the primary goal here. Not when we are trying to win over a friend or family member or coworker. So I would propose that we turn off the debate mode and turn on the conversation mode. That we keep it casual, friendly, low-key, non-threatening, and winsome. And the best tool to use in conversation mode is that of asking questions. Too often we try to persuade others by just asserting statements, beating it into them. But raising questions oftentimes can be far more effective. For instance, questions, if asked in a non-threatening way, lowers the defenses and conveys that you respect their opinions and beliefs. In a sense, you are inviting them to go first, that you are interested in their thoughts and that you will hear them out. Suppose you are discussing whether homosexuality is something people are born with. And then you say something like, well, even if it is genetic, that still doesn't make it right. All right, the statement's true. We spent time on that several weeks ago. However, the person at this point replies with, well, sure it makes it right. I can't deny how I've been created. All right, well, now what do? Assert yet another statement to counter that one, and their defenses are up, and in a sense, you've already lost, even though you may end up winning that particular argument. Again, keep in mind, the goal is to persuade them to replace that which is false with that which is true, and you want them to do this willingly. So you may have to take your time on this. Questions, unlike direct statements, invite discussion and are far more engaging. So a better reply might be, well, I'm curious to know your thoughts on this. Can you tell me why you think if something is genetic, it must be right? Or, I'm interested in your perspective on that. Do you think that any behavior is morally appropriate simply because it has a genetic link? Notice that even though you're asking a question, you're still making your point. You don't need to finalize the deal in 5 minutes or less. We simply want to keep the discussion going in the right direction. And to do that, we need to avoid anything that might come across as threatening or something that could be taken personally or anything that might provoke a contentious reaction. Another way to incorporate questions into your conversation is to use the burden of proof rule. And this makes discussions about homosexuality a whole lot easier. The burden of proof is simply the responsibility to give credible reasons for one's point of view. And so when we let the other person go first, so to speak, and share their opinions about homosexuality, for instance, then the burden falls on them to defend what they say. It's not our burden, at least at this point in the discussion, to just jump on it and refute it. And too often we ignore this, you know, and I'm the first to admit I'm guilty of this all the time. But we need to be careful. Someone says something like, Christianity is a homophobic religion. And then off we go defending ourselves, refuting it. And it's unnecessary to jump in and interrupt, you know, even though we are eager to correct. Sit back and let them do the work. You know, they made the statement. It's up to their job to back it up. Simply ask, how did you come to that conclusion? Or what reasons do you have for thinking that's true? And then listen, your turn will come. You know, this can be used for all sorts of claims that they might make. Homosexual relationships are just as valid as heterosexual ones. Explore that with them using questions. People should just let others do whatever they want to and butt out, and so on. You know, keep it going. More questions. Help them to see where their conclusions lead them. Eventually, they will turn to us and ask what we think or what we believe about or whether such and such is true or not. Then this then becomes our invitation, and it's an invitation to present our statements, and hopefully we'll make statements that are responsible, effective, true, and ones that we can defend. Otherwise, you should say, well, I don't know about that. Let me get back with you on that later, and then follow up. All right, now, this soft approach may seem to be a bit unnecessary, given the fact that the truth is on our side, and we shouldn't have to be sheepish in asserting it. I understand that. But two things here. Remember, we live in a world that believes that Christians hate homosexuals, and so the well has already been poisoned. Things are against us. We have to go out of our way to be disarming in our approach, and a conversational approach that incorporates questions to make our point is going to work a whole lot better for us in such an environment. Secondly, showing gentleness and respect, presenting our points in wisdom and grace, is what the scriptures actually command us to do anyway. So with that in mind, let's now move on and talk about what it means to actually speak the truth in love. And I have three principles that we should consider. I can go over these here fairly briefly. And again, just to be clear, these would apply to our interaction with non-believers. It's a different ballgame when talking with believers who may be wrong about something. But on this one, we're talking about non-believers again. First, should go without saying, but let's just say it, we need to treat homosexuals as you would anyone else. And it's obvious advice, but Christians, let's just face, you know, the fact is they just act differently when around them. They're uneasy. Their verbal non-communication, behavior, and direction of their conversation typically changes. So we need to show them the same dignity, kindness, and respect you would show someone who isn't. If you have the opportunity, don't be afraid to make friends. And in so doing, you will create for yourself opportunities to speak the truth to them. And always keep in mind that in all your interactions with them, that the ultimate goal is that more than just leading them to heterosexuality, but it's to lead them to holiness. There's far more here than trying to make homosexuals straight. We're trying to lead them to Jesus, just as we would anyone else who is lost. And once they place their trust in Him, He then can transform their lives. Secondly, don't make the gospel more offensive than it already is. Well, the gospel certainly is offensive. It claims that we are all sinners deserving of punishment and that we need a pardon. And these are not the sorts of things that people want to hear. The message itself, as Jesus said it would be, is a stumbling block to many. And so let's not put up even more obstacles. We do not want to convey, even implicitly, that God hates homosexual behavior more than any other sin, because he doesn't. We don't want to leave the impression that one has to become straight before he can come to Christ. That's not true. Here's another example of erecting an unnecessary obstacle. A common tactic when responding to the "since homosexuality is natural, it must be moral" argument is to offer this counterexample. You hear it all the time. Well, pedophilia is natural to some people. Well, that doesn't make it moral. All right, again, this response may be technically correct, but it is unnecessarily harsh and often misunderstood. People tend to muddy it up, thinking that you are suggesting that all homosexuals are pedophiles. A more gentle and respectable response might be to ask, if lying were to keep yourself out of trouble were natural, if lying to keep yourself out of trouble were natural, would that make it right? In contrast, the counterexample makes the same point without the offensive content. And while we're at it, this is a big one, it's way past time to retire the slogan, God hates the sin, but not the sinner. It's way time we put that thing to rest. Like other things, it may be true, but unfortunately, they only hear one word. What word do they hear when you say that? The word what? Hate. These same-sex feelings that they have, they're very real, and statements like this one strike at the core of who they perceive themselves to be. And when we claim that something that is so central to their being is hated by God, well, of course they're going to put their walls up. Of course they won't want anything to do with the gospel. Of course they're going to accuse us of being judgmental and mean-spirited. Our goal is to help them see Jesus as the living bread from heaven, the humble servant and merciful high priest, the great healer, man's savior and deliverer, not someone who hates who we are. Thirdly, making a long-term difference is more important than making a short-term statement. This third point here is all about moving things forward. As mentioned earlier, we sometimes act as if our most important goal is to change one's homosexual behavior in the short term, rather than waiting patiently to make a more significant difference in the future. So let me use a hypothetical example to flesh this out. Let's say, for instance, you might tell our son in college that he can't bring his homosexual lover home for the weekend, something a lot of people face. We want to make a moral stand, and we do not want to do anything that might compromise our convictions. And this is noble. It's certainly an acceptable course of action to take. It really is. But you have to consider that it does come at a cost, and this whole thing needs to be weighed out carefully. In drawing a line in the sand like this, you could jeopardize opportunities to influence both your son and his boyfriend. Your son already knows your feelings about his homosexual lifestyle, and you're not going to change that by telling him his boyfriend is unwelcome. So, an alternative could be something like this. Perhaps he and his friend can come home for the weekend, but while he is in your house, all parties must respect your convictions on the matter and honor some reasonable rules. No displays of affection, separate bedrooms. You will relate as friends, not lovers, which includes what you say in the house and at the dinner table. And future visits will depend on how this one goes, and so on. So these sorts of rules preserve your convictions on the matter. No homosexual behavior in my home. And yet, at the same time, you're treating the individuals with a level of respect and grace. By bringing his boyfriend into your home, you now have an opportunity to develop with him a relationship which can allow you to have a positive influence on him. And it is certainly not off limits, since he is a guest in your home, to engage him in a conversation about the subject and use lots of questions. And even more importantly, you are not burning bridges with your own son. You are going the extra mile to keep that relationship intact. The point is, and there are all sorts of variables in this, factors that could sway it one way or the other, but just as a general example, but the point is, in all the various situations that you face, think through things carefully. There are times when you might have to draw a line in the sand right then and there and stick to it. Other times, it might be better to think long term and respond to the situation in a way that sets you up to make a greater impact later on. I'm sure that all of us can look back at times in our past when we burned bridges prematurely. Okay, this then sets us up quite well for next week, part 11 of this series, when I plan to talk about real-life situations. How do we handle all these awkward settings that we find ourselves in? We'll probably start with the example of what do you do when a family member invites you to a same-sex ceremony, same-sex wedding, that sort of thing. We'll use that one as our starting point. And what we're going to do is lay out some overall principles and then see how we can best apply those to that situation and other scenarios as well. So, upon that, let's bring the children in from Sunday school, and let's stand, and the musicians can come forward, and we'll continue our time of worshiping the Lord.